OTB Sports Radio.
This Sunday on OTB Sports Radio, we're bringing you an exclusive first listen of a special interview with Muhammad Ali's former business manager, Gene Kilroy. The last survivor from Ali's inner circle joined myself, Shane Hannan, for an hour full of great insight and never-before-told stories, such as this from just minutes before the rumble in the jungle when Ali fought George Foreman.
Ali had no fear.
And the time Ali went looking for Joe Frazier.
Ali gets out of the car, the cops said, "Where do you think you're going?" He said, "I'm looking for Joe Frazier. Where's Joe Frazier?"
Hear it first this Bank Holiday Sunday at 7 p.m. exclusively on OTB Sports Radio. Listen on offtheball.com or download the Go Loud app.
The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM.
With Aviva, Ireland's largest insurer, celebrating 10 years of iconic sporting moments at the Aviva Stadium.
Look up on Patrick's Hill. Who would you take down? Who would you take down?
OTB AM's Mount Rushmore.
Right, we're doing Cavan. I feel a little bit uncomfortable about this. We've got Dave McIntyre doing it. Dave, this is the most tenuous link we've had anybody doing as a selector so far. So you're, first off, going to have to prove your own credentials before we go any further here. Explain to us why you are selecting. Good morning to you, first off. How are you? I hope you're well. First off, though, prove your work, Dave.
This has been as bad a start to this as I could ever have dreamt of, or indeed had in my nightmares, questioning my Cavan links and my credentials to actually be part of this process. As all I need to say, Jerry, and I say this to my father many times, I am more Cavan than he is. I am purebred. Both sides of my family are from Cavan. Three of my four grandparents are from Cavan. My grandmother was from Monaghan, which makes my father less of a Cavan man than I. What sort of further extolling of my own credentials do you require?
I just want to make sure that everybody out there understands them, Dave. I know this, you know. Sometimes, like Matlock, I know the answer to the question before I ask it, but there are people out there who are, why is that guy? He's a Dub. He's got a Dublin accent, lives in Dublin, lived in Dublin all his life. What's he doing picking our Mount Rushmore? I just want to make sure that everybody out there is happy with it. Paul Fitzpatrick, good morning to you. How are you? Do you accept Dave McIntyre's bona fides for this?
I think we'll take him as a true blue. We'll take everyone we can get, Jared, at this stage.
Very good. Well, people will be familiar with Paul's work in the Anglo-Celt, but he's also an author and historian when it comes to the great Cavan football teams too. So the way this is going to work is the way it's worked forever. Dave picks his four, Paul gets to edit that, fix it, put one on, and that's it. Then it's done forever. We should get into this. I think Hugh Horrigan of the Boar's Head is going to be our final pitch, which might be important when we get to the football. We should start with the bits where I think everybody is going to be in agreement. Who's your first person, Dave?
Well, firstly, I should say that when this was asked of me, I initially thought this will be pretty easy. Because while Cavan has an incredible pedigree for sport and Cavan's people are as proud of their sports history as any other county, they don't necessarily have the huge list of names that maybe a Dublin or a Kerry or a Mayo or a Kildare might have had. But it's only when you get into it and when I put it up on Twitter that I realised this is not going to be anywhere close to being as easy a process as I thought it might be. And the amount of people who got back to me on Twitter suggesting names, I mean, the list is as long as my arm. So I think you're right, there will be a couple of them that are absolute certs. I'm going to start with one of them. And I'm going to start with Katrina McKiernan. I would find it very difficult for anyone to put forward an argument that she shouldn't be on it. What do we need to say about Katrina? She's regarded as one of the world's best ever cross-country runners. She's won four successive silver medals at the World Cross-Country Championships between 92 and 95. She won gold at the European Cross-Country Championships in 94. She's won the London Marathon, the only Irish woman to do so. She's won the Berlin Marathon. She's won the Amsterdam Marathon. She's still the Irish marathon record holder, ran for Ireland in the Olympics. And I would also say it's not even just that her career, because since she's retired, she's become a fitness trainer. She's become an expert on the mechanics of racing and how to get people to race in a safe and an injury-free way. She's a legend of Cavan sport, but she's also one of the great distance runners on the national scene as well. And interestingly, when I was doing my research, she was only born 2 days apart from Sonia O'Sullivan, which is incredible. And the two of them had a really good rivalry as well in the 90s in particular. It's very difficult to see a Mount Rushmore somewhere up around the sleeve Russell and not have Katrina's face on it.
Yeah, Paul, this is as clear-cut an example as any county has had at any stage. Katrina McKiernan straight up there, first ballot.
Yeah, she's first ballot. Like, I think if you couldn't find one person in Cavan who wouldn't put Katrina McKiernan on their Mount Rushmore there. I think it's not alone her achievements. It's the context of her career, where she came from, like Cornafin, rural West Cavan, rural Cavan, absolutely no tradition of athletics, and at the time nobody got into running. She always tells a story about how she used to go running on the roads, and she'd get one of her sisters or her brother to go with her because she was so shy. She's a very shy personality, and someone local spotted her, one of the old characters, and walked into the local pub, McShane's in Cornafin, and he made the comment that there's a daughter of John McKiernan's out running the roads, and I wouldn't mind, but the McKiernans are good people. So that'll tell you what we thought. They thought this was sort of deranged behaviour. So she had that to go up against as well. And then she had no facilities. I've interviewed her a few times, and she always says that, you know, people talk about facilities and altitude training, warm weather training. She didn't have access to any of that for a lot of her career, especially in her early days. But she just had a fierce desire, competitiveness. And she just went running on the fields. The family had a farm. She ran around the fields and she played some camogie. And then I think it was 1988, she entered the schools cross country with very little training, probably no formal training. And she won the Irish schools cross country, which then she knew she had a talent for it. And she just worked really, really hard and had a huge Cavan support. I mean, when Katrina was doing really well in the early 90s, the football team was doing badly. They went 7 years in a row without winning a game championship. And a lot of that football support, which the football base would be in that area where Katrina's from, but a lot of that sort of transferred over to her as well. So she got a whole county behind it. So absolutely, 100% first pick for me.
I don't think we can underestimate just how difficult it is to win the London Marathon and how big an achievement that was as well. Like, the cross-country career is brilliant in and of itself, but the marathon running career is absolutely spectacular.
Oh, yeah. Like two hours, 22... 23 was her time, which is still the Irish record, and that we're 22 years on from when she won in London. Incredible, fastest ever debut marathon by a female runner. Like just insane what she managed to achieve. Probably was unlucky in terms of the cycles of her career that she didn't make a splash at the Olympics because she was injured in 2000, and then she didn't feel she had enough preparation done in 2004, so she had to miss out there in those two Olympics, which probably gave her the edge. Give Sonia the edge on international sport and consciousness, but really there was very little between them.
Is there a Katrina McKiernan legacy that you can discern, Paul, in terms of athletics clubs that sprouted up on the back of this success, or is it going to be an outlier that there won't ever be another Cavan Katrina?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jared. It possibly was an outlier. I know Katrina, even though she lives in Dublin, and I know she runs every day in Phoenix Park, and As Dave said, she's involved in chai running and stuff like that. But she comes back every year for this annual event called the Run with Katrina, where they get like maybe the guts of 1,000 runners at all levels and walkers. And you get from the elite runners around the country. It's part of a national series of races. So you get the elite runners. You also get all these people who are like that go out for a fun run. And that's huge. And she runs it herself, and she's really competitive. And she tries to win it, and she usually does win it. And she runs the 10K part of it, and maybe she... I don't know what her time would be, but it'd be maybe half an hour or so, and generally she wins it. But yeah, there is a legacy. There's been some good athletes came after her. I suppose Clodagh O'Reilly is one that went on a scholarship to Stony Brook College in New York, middle distance runner as well, kind of like Katrina. She was tall and really, really good over the ground. But you know, Katrina, it wasn't a thing that the support structure was in place for her, so it was kind of hard to replicate that. I think she was just one in a million. No matter where she was born, she was going to do it, but she just had that inbuilt drive.
Yeah, look, it's truly a brilliant international career coming, as you say, from a small farm in Cavan and running in the fields and running on the roads there to go from there to win in London and Berlin, as Dave says, straight up on Mount Rushmore. I think we should go handball next, Dave, just to so the areas of contention we leave to the end.
Yeah, I think the most areas of contention will surround Gaelic football. And look, Cavan are the aristocrats of Ulster football, no matter how difficult life may have been for Cavan GAA fans over the last half a century or so. But if we move towards the handball situation, and look, this is a name that was always going to come up, and I probably would have been in a very difficult position to try and explain away his absence if Paul Brady wasn't on the Cavan Sporting Mount Rushmore. He's an absolute legend of the handball world. Paul is, I know, a huge handball aficionado himself, so he'll be in a better position to explain why what Paul has achieved is as incredible as it is. But just to go through some of the numbers, like, he was actually born just 13 days before me, and yet he's still been winning titles almost up to his 40th year. He is... He won his first world title in 2003. He was the first Irishman to win that. It was really the reserve of Americans and Canadians before that. And this is a championship that's only held every 3 years. He won five in a row, which is astonishing, that durability and the ability to come back every 3 years and fend off the competition despite, you know, the advancing years. He's won more US national singles titles, 11 of them, than anybody else in history. From an Irish point of view, he's won over 20 All-Ireland titles between singles and doubles. He was the man that really replaced Duxie Walsh, the legendary figure that dominated Irish handball for so long. And Duxie was the name that was on everybody's lips whenever they were asked, maybe as a casual follower of the sport, who was the big name in the sport. It was always Duxie Walsh. So then along came Paul Brady. And he won some of his titles in the most unbelievable circumstances, with ruptured muscles and tendons, broken fingers. He won a couple of his titles almost on one leg. And that's before you mentioned the fact that he was trying to combine that with almost a decade-long career wearing the blue of Cavan in the inter-county setup as well. He was first brought into the panel in 02 by Matty Kerrigan, and the duress his body was under for about a 5 or 6 year spell, where he was trying to compete in the professional circuit in the States on the handball court. And there was a lot of money to be won in some of the biggest tournaments, and then keep himself fit to play club football with Mullaghorin and play in the All-Ireland and the Ulster Championship and the league with Cavan. It almost broke him in some ways. And eventually he had to shy away from the dual role and focus solely on his handball career. But given what he's done for Cavan and the pride with which Cavan people hold him up around Mullaghorin and throughout the county, it's very difficult to see him out Rushmore without Paul Brady on it.
Paul Fitzpatrick, explain to the rest of the non-handball world just how amazing Paul Brady was.
Yeah, I'm just laughing at Dave calling me a handball aficionado. It's a thin line between aficionado and zealot. But I'll try not to be too...
Go for it. Take the pulpits.
Yeah, well, I suppose, first of all, with Paul Brady, there's a tradition in handball where there would be a great champion who would dominate a certain era, and then someone else would take over. And that's been the way right back to the 1930s. Now, you had John Joe Gilmartin from Kilkenny, was a great player in the 20s. And then you had this fellow called Paddy Perry from Roscommon. And that went right through in the 60s, 70s. Obviously, as Dave mentioned, Duxie Walsh came through there. But there is that tradition where you would have a dominant figure. More often than not, you would have. But what Paul Brady did was he actually changed the game. In a way, you could compare him to Stephen Tuckton, because he changed the way the game was played. And you asked me earlier on about the legacy of Katrina McKernan. You can really see it with Paul Brady, because I'm involved in the game and I can see all the young boys and girls coming up playing handball. And they're all playing a different style of handball than anyone played 20 years ago, which is handball traditionally was, the analogy that was used was a sword and shield. So if you imagine a handball player in the court, your right hand, let's say you're right-handed, your right hand was your sword. That's what you used to attack with. And your left hand was your defensive weapon. That was your shield. And they always talked about, you know, both needed to be equal. Paul Brady came along and he played sword on sword. He literally was an all-out attacking player, got himself into phenomenal shape, was unbelievably powerful. His core strength and his lower body strength in particular was amazing, which meant that he was always set for the shot. So he could play at this level of intensity that players just couldn't cope with. Their legs would go, and it didn't matter how fit they were. Only the very, very top players could really live with Paul Brady in a long game. Now, that's not to say that he had it all his own way. Over the years, as Dave mentioned, he had so many things to overcome. You know, in 2003, he beat Tony Healy in the world final in Crow Park. And Paul cramped up at the time. He used to get a problem with cramp at the time, because he was one of these really, really driven individuals. And I think it meant so much to him. He used to get so much nervous tension, and he used to cramp at the time. So he cramped up, and there's a rule in handball you can take an injury time out. And but there's no injury timeouts are allowed for cramp. That's in the rule book. So there was an American referee in the game, and he just totally emotionless, and he just walked in and said, "No, game over. You've used up your timeouts, and you can't take an injury timeout." And Tony Healy, who from Cork, who he was playing, to his eternal credit, said, "Let him take my timeout." Tony didn't want to be handed a world title like that. But Paul came out, took Tony's timeouts, which is totally unprecedented in the sport, and got a bit of a rub from a physio, and I suppose the adrenaline and everything else went back, and he managed to win the game, literally hobbling on one leg. Then he went on and won the Worlds again in 2006. Then in 2009, he tore a muscle on his quad, literally the muscle detached from the bone. So he went to see a specialist. He was doing a box jump in the gym, and the box slipped. So you can imagine the violence of that, what it did to his leg. So he went to see a specialist in London, and the specialist was like, "Look, kind of preparing for life after competitive handball." And he was saying, "You don't understand. I'm going to be going to Portland, Oregon. I'm going to attend the tournament." And that was the sort of determination that he had. So he went on, he won it in 2009, then he won again in 2012, and then 2015 he won it in Canada. And now there's actually been another chapter to his career, because after he won in Canada, he beat this young fella from Cork called Killian Carroll, who is absolutely incredible. He's as incredible an athlete as there is in the country at present. He's sort of, you compare him in stature, he's sort of like Tony McCoy, I would say. He's about 5'6", absolutely lean, totally fearless, and throws his body around the court with absolute abandon, has no care for his own safety, and he's an extraordinary young player. He sort of took over from Brady quickly. No one saw it coming. And in 2016, he beat Paul in America. 2017, he beat him again. 2018, they were on a collision course in the Worlds, and Paul had to pull out before the semi-final again with injury after getting a badly sprained ankle. 2019, Brady, in his 40th year, comes back and wins the US Nationals. Now, he didn't beat Killian Carroll directly. Killian Carroll was beaten along the way, but Paul won the tournament at 40. So that was an unbelievable sort of a last chapter in his career. And he's still going. He was going to have another crack at it this year, but it looks like with the lockdown, it mightn't happen. But he's still there. Yeah, incredible. And also, as a footballer, he was a really good footballer. You know, he probably was unlucky to play in a team that was plenty of talent in that Cavan team, but for different reasons, they didn't make breakthrough. But he was a very good footballer and extremely good club player. He won 3 senior championships.
Okay, so Katrina McKiernan is on. Paul Brady's on. There's no doubt about that. Is there, Dave? He's straight on, right?
Well, look, there may be someone who can put an argument together that will turn my head, but I find it highly unlikely, Jared. This guy, there aren't many multiple world champions in Irish sport. Paul Brady is one of them. There aren't many that have won 5 in a row over a 12-year period. I mean, how can you not have him on the mountain?
Yeah, and we've definitely not got the right person to make an argument against him with you today, I think. the bases are loaded here, and that's fine. Paul Brady straight up on the mountain as well. I think everybody can agree with that. So the next two, I don't think we have agreement on. Who have you got, Dave?
This is an incredibly difficult part of the process. We know Cavan is a GAA county, a Gaelic football county, and they were one of the great GAA counties, certainly for the first 50 or 60 years of the GAA, and they won 5 All-Ireland, and they've won 39 Ulster titles, and they're over the course of those years, there have obviously been legendary figures. And we're going to argue over this one, I would suspect. And it's probably going to be an argument that I won't be able to win, because I will be in a position where I'll end up arguing against myself, because I'm not even 100% sure that I've picked the right two people. There are obviously so many notables, and Cavan fans of the last 25 years of my ilk, I started following Cavan maybe around 84, 85. And there's only been one Ulster title in that time. There's been one Ulster title in the last 51 years, 1997. If you go back to 1969 for the one before that. And that 1997 day in Clonus, when Jason Riley and the goal against Derry and the jersey over the head, that is still the single greatest day of sporting fandom in my life. So it's very difficult to look beyond guys like Dermot McCabe and Larry Riley. And Stephen King, who was just such an inspirational captain and a soldier for Cavan for so long. And Dermot obviously won an All-Star and played international rules for Ireland. Larry did as well. But the achievements of the Cavan teams of the 30s and 40s and 50s, I think, will probably trump it for me. So the first guy I'm going to go with is John Joe Riley, who, like Katrina McKiernan, was from Cornafane. He won two All-Irelands. He captained the side in the Polo Grounds in 47. He was again in part of the team that won the next year in 48. He won 11 Ulster Championship medals, which is an unbelievable haul. Throw in a league medal, four Railway Cup medals as well. And this, of course, is at a time when the Railway Cup was a far more prestigious event than it became in latter years. He was named on the football team of the century in 1984. And then when they followed it up at the end of the millennium, he was named on the team of the millennium in 1999 in the centre-half back position. And one thing about John Joe Riley as well, and I kind of put him in the sort of the Jim Morrison, James Dean sort of a category. He was taken all too young. So tragically, he picked up a really bad injury while playing a game of Gaelic football at the age of 34. And he died later that year in 1952, the year of Cavan's last All-Ireland. And if anything, his premature death has added to his legend over the years, because Cavan people never got to see him grow old, never got to see or hear him talk about his days in a Cavan jersey. They only ever remembered that young superstar, that swashbuckling centre half back. His dad and his brother also played for the county. He's one of just eight men to have been presented the Sam Maguire as captain on at least two occasions. There's a great song that was written about him, Gallant John Joe. He's just one of the legendary figures of not just Cavan GAA, but the GAA in general over the last 130 years. And he definitely deserves a place on this mountain, in my opinion. He's one of the great Gaelic football names.
Paul, what happened? How did he die?
Yeah, it's a contentious one. I think people thought the Shawnee Johnston controversy was the start of the Cavan and Kildare rancor, but John Joe Riley actually picked up an injury playing in a club match in Kildare. He was playing against Ardclough, and something happened. People say that it was that he got a kick. Something happened in the game anyway. He had previously refereed a game against the, where they weren't happy with some decisions. So people said there was a bit of vendetta against him. But it ended up that he got a very bad kidney ailment, and he was in the army in the Curragh. See, John Joe had a huge connection with Kildare. Like, he was gone from Cavan really from the age of 18 on. He was down in the Curragh. He applied to join the cadets. And when I wrote the book about 47, his nephew Brian, who was a chemist in Naas, gave me some of his old letters where he had his character references and stuff like that. When he applied for the cadets, and then the commendations that he got from his superior officer, so he was described as absolutely first class officer material. And he went on then. So this, aside from his football career, he was just a leader of men. He was the youngest ever commandant in the history of the Irish Army, and was earmarked as a future chief of staff. Hugely popular figure among his teammates around the country. He was just one of these absolute supermen. You know, in the days before TV, he was sort of like a Cucullin type figure around Ireland. The fact that he died young definitely added to his luster as well. You know, and as the song says, new players may come, old players may go, but we never have the likes of the gallant John Joe. Like, I do think, yeah, he's a towering figure, but yeah, I am going to argue with it, Dave.
Well, we probably don't need to get to the argument just yet, do we, Ger?
Well, we can do if like so. How many? So you've picked John Joe Riley from the 47, from that era. What's your other footballer?
Well, there's two of the GAA names that, I mean, there's a couple that we certainly should get a mention. Like, Ollie Brady was Cavan's first All-Star Award winner. That was back in 1978. But like many Cavan players over the last 50 years, he was unfortunate enough to be part of a Cavan side that wasn't really achieving anything. I'm thinking of guys like Charlie Gallagher, who would be a real favourite of my father and my uncle's generation, for example. He was a real swashbuckling attacking forward. He was a showman in the 60s and was part of the Ulster Whip title winning side in the late 60s. And a lot of people, while he didn't win an All-Ireland, would love to see him in the mix. But the two men that, outside of John Joe, that I would have to see talked about in real detail, one of them is Mick Higgins and the other one is Hughie Riley. Now, Mick, his story is just absolutely incredible. And what I always knew of him, and I, for example, Mick, when he died in 2010, he was actually buried in the same cemetery as my grandfather and my grandmother and my grandaunt. And it was something I always was aware of, knowing that he had seen out his final days in Virginia, where my father grew up. And I would have asked my uncles and father about Mick Higgins over the years. But Mick Higgins was born in New York, and then he moved to Cavan. Depending on where you read, I'm sure Paul will have the exact detail, but between the ages of 5 and 10. But he played in 5 All-Ireland finals. He won 3 of them. And 1947 was appropriate as well, given that it was back in his native city of New York. He won in 48. He was the captain in 52. And he scored 7 of Cavan's 9 points in the replay win that year. 7 Ulster Championship medals. And that alone would almost be enough for someone of his stature to make it onto the mound. But then you look at what he achieved after he retired. Because he's most remembered as a player, obviously. But his record as a manager and a trainer, I mean, absolutely unbelievable. He retired, then managed Cavan. He led them to 3 Ulster titles on the sideline. He led them to the All-Ireland final in 59. That was the last time Cavan contested an All-Ireland decider. And even then, that's something special. He moves on to train Longfordshire. Now, Longford have a rich GA history, but they haven't achieved much on the inter-county scene. They've won 1 Leinster title. And that was in 1968. And who was the manager? Who was the trainer that year? It was Mick Higgins, the Cavan man, which was absolutely astonishing. And that was 2 years after he led them to a league title. And they beat that unbelievable All-Ireland 3 in a row winning Galway side in 1966. So that's incredible in itself. He moves on to Donegal. And he's part of the training regime that helps them win their first Ulster title in 1972. He was also a really well-renowned referee. There was actually 1 year where he took charge of an Ulster semi-final in the 1950s between Derry and Down, and that was despite the fact that his Cavan team, which he was training, were awaiting the winners of that semi-final in the final. Could you imagine trying to sell that today in today's GAA? Texaco Hall of Fame entry in 1989, and I read a really amazing piece by another legendary GA figure in Eugene McGee, who in the last decade, as well as Mick Higgins, we've obviously lost. He said that Mick Higgins would be considered at least in the 25 best players of all time. And I'll leave my argument for Mick Higgins with something that Mick himself said. He was once asked what his legacy should be, and he said that, "I never hit anyone, I played a clean game, and I was never put off." So he would be my 4th man on the Cavan Mount Rushmore. I haven't got into Hughie Riley, who was the only person to have been involved in all of Cavan's All-Ireland titles as a player and a manager. Maybe he's worth a long mention as well, but that's Mick Higgins.
Right. Will we do your football, Paul, before you make one final case for somebody outside of the world of football? So you actually do want to put Hughie O'Reilly on your mountain, is that right?
Yeah, I want to put Hughie O'Reilly on mine. I describe him as the godfather of football, not just in Cavan, but in Ulster. Because if you look at his list of achievements, so Cavan's first All-Ireland at any level was a junior All-Ireland in 1927. Armagh had won a junior All-Ireland before that, but Cavan won this in 1927, which was seen as a big breakthrough. Hughie O'Reilly was the captain of that team. In 1928, Cavan got to the All-Ireland final, lost to Kildare again. Hughie O'Reilly was on that team. In 1933 and 35, they made a breakthrough and they won 2 All-Irelands, and he played midfield on both of those. He played in 37, where they lost the final in a replay. Then he took over the team in the 40s, and he was over the Cavan team when they got to the All-Ireland final in 43, which they again lost in a replay. 45, they lost by a point to Cork. And then the glorious era kicked in where he was over the Cavan team where they won the Polo Grounds in New York in 47, again in 48, lost the All-Ireland final in 49 in a replay, and then won the All-Ireland in 52. So by my count, I was just totting it up last night, he was involved as a player or a manager, including replays, in 13 All-Ireland senior finals. He was involved in every winning Cavan All-Ireland team, including that first junior team. And he was a very, very interesting character in that the family had connections in Cork. So he was O'Reilly. He obviously was a Cavan man, but I think his father had lived in Cork for a while. The family lived down there in Cork City, but he was heavily involved in the Republican movement, and he was active in the War of Independence and in the Civil War. He was interned for a while. He moved back up to Cavan. I think it was something to do with the political end of it. Maybe there was a bit of heat on where he was. He came back to Cavan, and Cork's loss became Cavan's gain because he moved to the home of an old relation outside Coothill in Tullyvin, and became heavily involved in the Coothill Celtic Club, and who were a famous club. They were like one of these, they were obviously the Celtic colours, and Charlie Gallagher was one of their most famous sons, but they were a really famous club, and Hughie put them on the map, I suppose, back in that era. He also went on to train Coot-Hill when they won a three in a row. There were only three senior championships in the mid-1950s as well. And he was a famous disciplinarian. He ran his the cabin football team along military lines, literally. You know, he literally would get them to march up and down in the mornings and things like that. Stuff that he had probably learned when he was involved in that kind of stuff himself. Wasn't a man for the limelight at all. And once he sort of, after the 50s, he finished with being involved in football with his local club. He just lived a quiet life in Coot-Hill. He wasn't involved really with anything else. Now, he's regularly listed on the whenever there's a list of the top 100 most influential GAA people or anything like that, you know, he's well up the list. For me, I would say we couldn't have a Mount Rushmore without Hughie O'Reilly on it, because without him, you'd wonder, would Cavan have had the success they had? He was involved in so many breakthrough successes, you know, from the start. He was the man that was there, that was breaking new ground. And when Hughie O'Reilly stepped away in the mid-1950s, you know, then you had that period of flux, which I always think is probably one of the most fascinating periods in Ulster football. People talk about the early 90s, obviously, when Ulster was winning everything. But in the late 50s, so up until 1955, Cavan were beaten in an All-Ireland semi-final replay by Kerry that year. And everything was going good. This is where we were and where we always had been and where we should be. Winning Ulster out of Cantor, getting to All-Ireland semi-finals. A good year was defined by if you got to the All-Ireland final or not. The Ulster championship was taken as a given. But suddenly in 55, Tyrone came in 56 and won Ulster, and then they retained it in 57. Then in 58, Derry came and won their first Ulster title. That year, Cavan didn't even get to the Ulster final for the first time. 59, Down broke through then, won Ulster, hammering Cavan in the Ulster final. And then 60 and 61, Down obviously won two All-Irelands. So you can just imagine the devastation there was in Cavan. You know, there were people writing letters into the Anglo-Celt saying, like, this is an absolute national scandal. Because bear in mind that the Anglo-Celt described Cavan's win in 1933 as an event of international importance. So this is what football meant. But Hughie O'Reilly had stepped away from the Cavan team. So maybe there was something to do with that as well. That period of flux, that 7 years is when Cavan opened the door and let the other teams in Ulster in. And we never got the back out of the house, unfortunately.
Before we get to the debate about from the football perspective who's going up, I want to just take us on a little bit of a tangent here, Paul, because you didn't have two footballers, you had one footballer and you had a golfer on your mountain.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I'm a friend of the pod, as they say, on Golf Weekly, and I know Dave is a big golf fan, and I just cannot believe, Dave, that you haven't got Leona Maguire in this list. I'm staggered. I'm actually disgusted. Looking through it. What she has achieved. I spoke to a few people in the lead up, and I mentioned that I was going to be coming on here. A couple of people said to me, Leona is a little bit young yet. She hasn't done enough yet. I would be of the belief that if she put down her golf clubs tomorrow and never played again, that she has done enough to be on any Mount Rushmore. Like at 25 years of age, if you look back through her career, she was winning adult scratch cups at the age of 12, along with her sister, Lisa, obviously. She won the Scottish Amateur at Troon at the age of 14. Like, the ordinary hacker, the likes of me, if I go to Troon, I'm driving past and I stop to take a photograph. At 14 years of age, she's out there playing on this course and beating the top amateurs in the UK. She obviously went on then, and she won the Mark McCormick medal as the leading female amateur in the world. Like, she broke Lydia Ko's record. Like, that in itself is just an astonishing achievement. She got a scholarship to Duke University, was obviously the top collegiate player then. Turned pro, has already got a top five finish. Did her year on the Symetra Tour, got her LPGA card, and already has a top five finish. And like, if you think about the depth of talent there is in golf, you know, and nobody loves handball more than I love handball, but I definitely wouldn't demean Paul's achievements, but I would say Leona is right up there, because the depth of the field that she was competing in. And also, we talked about Katrina's the context, you know, where Leona comes from in West Cavan in Ballyconnell, it's quite a deprived area. There would have been a lot of emigration over the years. Not a big history of sport and achievement. Like, at the moment, most of the GAA clubs in that area would be in junior ranks. And that's always been the way, really. Going back, even back in the 30s and 40s when Cavan were winning, you'd have maybe one player from West Cavan. And that's when football was the only sporting outlet there was in the area. So there was no big tradition of sport and achievement there. And what Leona and her sister Lisa achieved is just off the charts. I really think, Dave, that's got to be up there.
Right. what normally would happen now is we'd make Dave pick his four, you would make your change, we'd hear one last pitch, but I'm going to actually play the last pitch now because I think the last pitch is going to essentially hopefully decide who's going up from a football perspective, right? So from the boar's head, this is Hugh Hourican talking about who he thinks from a football perspective should go up, and then we'll decide whether or not Leona takes somebody off. So have a look at this.
Good morning, lads. When we think of Cavan legends, we think of Mick Higgins. Born in New York, came home and won a senior championship with Man Nugent. Leona played for Cavan in 5 All-Ireland finals, wearing the number 11 jersey. He won 3 of them, one of them in New York. 7 Ulster titles, 2 National Leagues, all-time All-Star Award, Texaco Hall of Fame. He moved on then and took over the Cavan Seniors, won 3 Ulster titles and a National League. He took our minors over, brought them to an All-Ireland final, 1959, narrowly beaten by Dublin. He went on then and took over Longford. National League, O'Byrne Cup, Leinster title. Moved on to Donegal, won the first Ulster title in 1972. Lads, this lad has done it all. Where is this man's statue? He should be up there on top of that mountain. We have Leanne Kiernan, Leona Maguire, Paul Brady, handball, Katrina McKernan, Dermot McCabe, Stephen King, John Joe Riley. Lads, Mick Higgins is on the wall of the boar's head. Put him up there, lads.
Right. That's an order, Dave. Looks like it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to having this argument with the man himself in the pub itself once we get through this COVID-19 crisis and we can get back to something similar to what life used to be like. I'm glad he's made the argument for Mick Higgins. He made it as a better leave than I could have done. Paul's argument on Leona is, look, it's well made. And I think I'm following in the footsteps of the off-the-ball representative in a lot of these Mount Rushmore discussions in that I've used her age as a bit of a get-out-of-jail-free card in that she is 25 and I can't imagine there are many 25-year-olds that have achieved more than she has in her young years, but it's just that she's only been a professional for the last couple of years. She's had her first top five finish, as Paul said, this year, and I think she's going to keep achieving at an unbelievable level. I read this morning 135 weeks at the top of the amateur world rankings, which is still a record. It's an outrageous achievement. And if we were to sit and have this discussion in 5 years time, and I'm not the first to sit in this chair and use this line over the last few weeks, she would absolutely be on them. And Leanne Kiernan was mentioned there as well. She's only 21, but she's already played 15 times to the Republic of Ireland. She's doing really well at West Ham United. And if her career continues to progress the way it is, there's a very good chance she would be up there as well in a few years' time.
But okay.
I'm not arguing against them. I just think their body of work is not yet complete. And when it is, they'd probably be up there because they're incredibly talented. So and they're inspirations to particularly young girls who are trying to make their way through the sporting world. They can look at what the likes of Leanne and Leona are achieving and continue to achieve and really take heart from it.
Okay, but you're sticking with your two footballers, Mick Higgins, John Joe Riley, Katrina McKiernan and Paul Brady. They're your final four until...
Yeah, I want to mention just a couple of other people quickly. I want to mention Killian Sheridan, who's still playing. And as someone said to me this week, the longest serving professional athlete in the history of Cavan sport. And he's an inspiration to a lot of young guys who are maybe struggling to make it in England or Scotland. And he shows what you can do if you've got the heart and the spirit and the risk-taking ability to go somewhere else and try and play your trade. He's played in Israel and Bulgaria and Poland and New Zealand. So I wanted to mention him just for what he's done over his career and the way he's kept at it. Andy Murray, professional boxer from Cavan, 2-time national champion, came very close to a world title in 2011. He deserves a mention as well. But when it comes to making that final decision, look, it's a bit of a chicken and egg. Would there have been a John Joe Riley and a Mick Higgins discussion if it wasn't for Hughie O'Reilly? I mean, you know, that's an argument that is very difficult to win or lose because I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer to it. But he was, as Paul said, the godfather of Cavan.
Okay,
football.
But you've got to pick.
I wouldn't be upset if Paul Forrest would have Mick or John Joe off the mountain. It's outrageous that I'm about to say that a man who was named the Centenary GAA Team of the Year and the Team of the Millennium is not going to be on it. But for me, what Mick Higgins went on to achieve as a manager with Cavan, Longford and Donegal It's and along with what he did as a player and what an unbelievably good centre back he was, and a free taker as well, or centre half forward rather, and a free taker, just about edges John Joe Riley off the mountain. And I know I'm going to be hung for this, because there are a lot of people of Cavan stock absolutely screaming in fury right now. But this is an impossible job. And if I have to choose between Mick and John Joe, I'm just going to go with Mick Higgins.
So hang on. You made a change. Who's on your mountain, Dave? Mick Higgins?
Well, I'm only going to get to hold on to three of them. So in the understanding that...
No. You let you leave Paul make his own mind up here. That's how this works. You pick your four. Who's your four? Who's your final four?
I'm not changing from my four. My four are Katrina, John Joe, Mick, and Paul.
Right. What were you at there, Dave?
I was trying to lay the groundwork for what I fear is about to happen.
Okay. Paul Fitzpatrick, the floor is yours. The mountain is yours. You can replace any one of those four with anybody in the world you want, so long as they qualify for Cavan's Mount Rushmore. Who's your change going to be?
I think John Joe's got to come out and Leona Maguire's got to go in there.
I mean, that was clearly what he was going to do, Dave. We all knew that. Have you not been paying attention? I think that's a great...
I'm horrified.
That's a great choice.
Not because Leona Maguire is on the mountain. I mean, she's a genuine superstar. But I just can't imagine in my mind's eye, on a drumlin somewhere in North Cavan, how this mountain face will look if I see four sports people on it and one of them is not the face of John Joe Riley. But this is Paul's doing, not mine.
No. It's a collective decision. So Paul Brady, Katrina McKiernan, Leona Maguire and Mick Higgins is what we have at the moment. This is your, as Chris Tarrant would say, final answer?
Is that my final answer?
Paul, is that your final answer? Leona's on.
Oh, sorry, Jerry. Yeah. Leona for me is right up there. Yeah, 100%. I think it would be a travesty if she didn't get on. Obviously, Mick Higgins, John Joe Riley, icons of the game. Like Dave, I think Mick, obviously John Joe passed away at 34 and Mick went on and achieved so much after he stopped playing. Probably achieved enough to get on, even if he had never kicked the ball, because he also trained a load of Ulster Railway Cup winning teams in the 60s as well. And he was also a great greyhound trainer. He was one of the very best greyhound trainers in the country. He was just that sort of individual that could turn his hand to anything. And he actually trained Longford at the same time as he trained Cavan. And the Cavan players of the 60s, remember, Mick was a very placid, serene man, very laid back and totally modest, but just a very calm type of individual. But the one time he ever really lost his temper was when Cavan played Longford in a playoff match in Crow Park once, and Longford were beating Cavan easily at halftime. And he was absolutely raging because he said the Cavan people are going to be laughing at him here, that he was had a foot in both camps, but his own Cavan team couldn't beat Longford. And he went mad. And in the second half, Cavan turned around and managed to win that game. So there's actually a really, really good story in Mick Higgins altogether. Like he was born the day Michael Collins was shot. And he obviously was born in New York. His father was from Kilchamah, Mayo. And his father had been a bus driver in New York, I think, and was a very talented runner out there. So you could see where the athleticism came in. But I think we could talk all day about Higgins. I think Higgins has got to be up there, but Leona as well.
And where are we going to build it, lads? Paul?
it's got to be down in West Cavan, Quilca Mountains, I think.
Fair enough. We'll take that, Dave, unless you had a better suggestion.
No, that's fine. I just feel sorry for Paul. His next trip towards Kilashandra or Kernaghan is going to be a difficult one. It's probably a part of the county that Paul will be... he's probably going to take a break from visiting for many years, I would suggest.
What about TB12, asks Barry Corrigan. Tom Brady. Tom's great-grandfather, Philip F. Brady, was a Cavan native who emigrated to the San Francisco Bay Area during the late 1800s. Drumlane GAA Club are claiming him. So, yeah, TB12... certainly his dad, anyway.
On that note, John McEnroe was raised during the week as well. Apparently, John's one of John McEnroe's great grandparents was from Cavan as well. So if we were going to go down the great granny rule, they would have been worth a shout.
Well, his brother did play Davis Cup for Ireland. Katrina McKiernan, Paul Brady, Leona Maguire and Mick Higgins. That is it for Cavan's Mount Rushmore.
OTB AM's Mount Rushmore.
OTB AM.
With Aviva, Ireland's largest insurer, celebrating 10 years of iconic sporting moments at the Aviva Stadium. That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.